National Geographic and the Times Picayune. They forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said. Now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted. Inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, because malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes.
Welcome to A Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Today we'll bring you an exclusive, just recorded specifically for Building Bridges. Disasters, natural and otherwise, race, class, and the destruction of New Orleans. Part 2 with Tim Wise. Tim Wise talks about the right-wing agenda, blaming the poor in New Orleans, how government helped to create poverty in New Orleans and the USA, how media misconception fed the myth of the supposed violence in New Orleans, and what is to be done so that the people are not left behind once again in the reconstruction of New Orleans.
Abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans.
I want to turn my attention now to this issue, the way that the right is trying to frame the aftermath of this disaster, because if we're going to understand the racial implications of Hurricane Katrina, we need to be prepared for what those on the right, who have, of course, always been particularly adept at exploiting racial cleavages, we have to be aware of what they are doing. We have a right wing who have been very active in promoting the idea that the reason that so many people were trapped was because, of course, they didn't have cars, and the reason they didn't have cars is because they don't have money, and the reason they don't have money is because they don't have jobs, and the reason they don't have jobs is because they don't want to work, and, of course, the reason they don't want to work is because they are all dependent on some type of welfare program. This argument is, of course, absurd. But in particular, I want us to examine the real history of how these communities in New Orleans, and for that matter around the country, became so poor. And it's a story of institutional racism. So let us look at a couple of particular communities that were very hard hit by this storm. I'm now speaking of the Treme, of the Iberville, and of the 7th Ward. These are communities that are on the far side of the French Quarter. These are communities that really, up until the middle of the 1960s, were some of the most prosperous black business communities in the South. In the case of the Treme, it had been a community which in the 20s and 30s had one of the largest public markets in the city of New Orleans. That public market was, as happened in so many places around the country, destroyed to make way for the economic development needs of the white community. In the case of the Treme, which was the first free African-American community in the United States, that market was destroyed to make way for the municipal auditorium. Later, beginning in the 1950s, the dozens and dozens of black businesses and hundreds of African-American working-class homes in the Treme, as well as in the Iberville and the 7th Ward, which was the heart of the old Creole community in New Orleans, were destroyed. That was done so as to bring the interstate through the area that we now recognize as Interstate 10 that runs through that part of the downtown area of New Orleans. And, of course, this was done not only in New Orleans, but in cities all around the country so as to make it easier for white suburbanites, who were pretty much the only folks who at that point were being allowed to live in suburbs thanks to really overt housing discrimination, making it easier for them to travel from their homes to their places of employment and back again. So as to meet the needs of more affluent whites, the interstates were brought through the heart of the black community in New Orleans. The black business district in the Treme in the 7th Ward were utterly destroyed. Houses were leveled, and there were no relocation funds or very little allocated to help relocate the families that were displaced, the businesses that were destroyed. And so as a result, you had a lot of families that had to double up with other relatives or had to move for the first time into public housing projects. These had been communities that, yes, had been poor prior to the development of the interstates in the communities, but they had been functional. They had had a strong, thriving black middle class in those communities. That did not change because of the welfare state. It changed because of institutional and structural policies that prioritize the needs of affluent white suburbanites and their need to commute back and forth more easily, and deprioritized and stampeded over the needs of those particular local black communities. This happened all across the country. Other forms of urban renewal, including building of shopping malls and office parks and parking lots in downtown areas, was destroying another 40,000 homes. By the early 1960s, already about 200,000 black and brown homes had been destroyed all across this country in the name of urban renewal and interstate highway development. So you had two things going on at once. One, was the subsidizing of white flight, the prioritizing of the needs of white affluent suburbanites, and then secondly was the urban renewal, or really a destruction of black business communities and black residences. And so you had a huge amount of displacement. You had a huge amount of enterprise and business that was devastated so as to benefit white folks. To the extent that this happened, we have to be looking at that as the precursor to the so-called welfare state, because it's one thing for the right to say, well, folks are now dependent on welfare, and as I'll show you in a second, that's very much untrue. But even were it true, we would still want to ask the question, why is it that people become dependent on various forms of public assistance or income support? And in this particular case, if we're looking at urban black America and urban America of color, we would have to recognize that the institutional, the structural policies of interstate construction, urban renewal, had an awful lot to do with that. When we talk about the welfare state, for example, as it relates to New Orleans, it's very interesting that anyone could believe that the folks they were seeing on television were the so-called welfare underclass. First of all, it's worth noting that in the city of New Orleans at the time of Hurricane Katrina, there were only 4,600 households in that entire city that were receiving cash welfare assistance, which is actually only about 2.5% of all the households in the city of New Orleans. So by definition, the people that we were seeing who were suffering were not the so-called welfare underclass, but that hasn't stopped right-wingers and even some who would probably consider themselves liberal from making that argument. So these myths that we were hearing about who the folks were that we were seeing were utterly inaccurate. And this brings us to the community that perhaps was most stigmatized and most affected in some ways by the storm, and that's the Lower Ninth Ward. The Lower Ninth Ward has always borne the brunt of the worst storms that hit the city, and it was, again, because of its low-lying position relative to the lake. It was also one of the hardest-hit communities this time. If you listen to much of the media commentating done by, again, mainstream media pundits, if you listen to what the Rush Limbaughs of the world and the Bill O'Reillys of the world were saying in the wake of this storm and the catastrophe, you would get the impression that the folks in the Lower Ninth Ward were only left behind because they didn't have enough money to leave, because they didn't work and they didn't want to work, and that was all, of course, because they had grown dependent on welfare. In fact, 71% of all the families in the Lower Ninth Ward get income from paid employment, and only about 8% report getting any kind of cash assistance or what we tend to consider government welfare. That's a ratio of roughly 9-1, and yet we continue to have these lies and myths. 6 out of 10 own their own homes. And the students in that community of the ages of, say, 16 to 19 actually have a lower high school dropout rate than the national average. So again, if you look at the communities about which people have been speaking so negatively, you find that the stereotypes and the myths are very little more or less than racist and classist propaganda. Even when people do rely on public assistance, we must be very clear that there is a story behind why a person goes on public assistance. After all, if the average annual amount that you're going to receive in the state of Louisiana from so-called welfare programs is $2,800 a year, you're certainly not going to go on these various forms of assistance to get rich. You're doing it for a number of reasons having to do with lack of job opportunities. There are systemic and structural issues of structural and built-in unemployment in this country, which we must, and especially at a time like this, examine. Nationally, several studies have suggested that in any given time, regardless of the strength or weakness of the economy, that there will be 7 to 10 people out of work for every job that pays an above poverty level wage. So what we're talking about is really a lack of job opportunities, and particularly in a city like New Orleans, where so many of the jobs are in the sub-poverty level wage categories of the hospitality industry, folks who work bussing tables in the restaurants, in the hotel industry. All the evidence suggests that the stereotypes of low-income folks in New Orleans, particularly in this case low-income African Americans, are false. And so I think the first and foremost thing that we must do when we hear these kinds of myths being bandied about is to be able to respond with facts and be able to point out the much bigger systemic issues. You'll notice whenever the unemployment rate drops, if it drops quote-unquote too far, the Federal Reserve Board will raise the interest rates to quote-unquote cool off the economy. The Fed fears that if too many people have jobs, they will be able to negotiate better wages with employers. If wages go up, prices will go up. And so as a way to restrain inflation, the Federal Reserve Board raises those interest rates to cool off the economy and prevent inflation from getting out of control. Now, putting aside whether or not that theory makes any sense, and there's actually a lot of economic evidence to suggest it's not a very legitimate theory, but even if we assume that it is, it also speaks to why people are poor. If you have a Federal Reserve that insists on raising the interest rates every time unemployment drops, let's say, below 5%, what that means is that you're going to have millions of people who will be out of work very much on purpose, because when those interest rates are raised, what happens? Well, employers can't hire more workers. They can't expand their plants and equipment. They can't expand production. production because now the cost of borrowing the money to increase their output is too expensive. And so if those interest rates rise, the hiring spree cools off, which means millions of people will now not be able to find work. And it won't be because they're lazy. It won't be because of a lack of a work ethic. It will be because of a very deliberate policy intended to maintain low prices. It means that the Federal Reserve is basically saying that 10, 11, maybe 12 million people are going to be kept out of work very much on purpose. If we understand that, then perhaps we can understand that when we see tens of thousands of people being quote-unquote left behind in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, that really what we're seeing is just a continuation of business as usual, folks who are regularly sacrificed for the sake of a quote-unquote healthy economy. This is not, again, something which is unique to Hurricane Katrina. It is standard operating procedure in this country. And now I want to turn to another area, because one of the obvious ways in which the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina has increased the problems that we already have in this nation with regard to race and class is the way in which the media portrayed these particular issues. If you examine the media coverage, we know that there was a significant amount of overt race and class bias in the way these stories were covered. So, for example, most of us saw the photographs that were circulating in which one individual who was African American and had a bag full of, we're not exactly sure what, wading through waist-deep water was captioned as a looter, and two white folks who were wading through similar waist-deep water with bags full of food, the caption under their photo said that they had found food, again giving the impression that white folks simply find things and that black folks steal things. There was another picture which was taken by an AP photographer in an outlying area, actually Jefferson Parish, which is mostly white, whereas Orleans Parish is mostly black. And in that particular photo, there was one black man, one white man. The black man was jumping through a broken window back out onto the street, and he didn't actually have any looted goods with him, though he had been in the store. The white man in the picture was walking away from the store with a bag of goods, and the caption under that photo referred to the white man and said that he was examining or looking through his shopping bag, which again, of course, you know, gives the impression that this man had just gone shopping, which of course is preposterous. He had gone stealing, and yet the way in which the photograph was presented, the way in which the caption was presented, reinforced these kinds of racial stereotypes that black people steal, black people loot, white people find things, or perhaps we go shopping. We also know that it wasn't just what the media did show us, it was also what the media did not show us. The media did not cover the looting of the Walgreens at the corner of Royal Street in Iberville, which is just outside the Hotel Monteleone, but according to reports of white folks who were there on the scene, there was indeed a looting of that Walgreens by white folks, including quite a few European tourists who, in the wake of this catastrophe, needing food, needing water, needing basic necessities, did what many folks on Canal Street did. The problem being that the cameras were there watching black folks, quote-unquote, loot, watching African-American folk take the things that they needed in order to survive. Again, most of that being food and water and diapers and clothes to replace the clothes that were rotting off their backs at that moment because they had been wading through waist-deep or thigh-deep water. But they were not further into the French Quarter at the time that these European tourists and other white folks were looting, but indeed it was happening. We don't have any photographs, though we do have a small caption in the USA Today 2 weeks ago about government officials in Kenner, which is also in Jefferson Parish, a very white suburb. Folks in Kenner in the government who are now under investigation for having taken donated items and stolen those and distributed them to friends and family. And these government officials are, of course, white in Kenner. And yet there's no picture, there's no video footage of them engaging in their particular theft, once again allowing this sort of stereotype of who steals and who doesn't steal to be maintained. We don't have video footage of the white folks, including, again, a very large number of European tourists who looted the Riverwalk Mall, which is right there actually above the casino if heading toward the river, and yet we have reports coming out of the area of the Riverwalk being looted. The media showed us the continual loops of African-American quote-unquote looters and simply did not show us the footage, though it certainly was there to be had, of white folks engaging in the same kind of activity. I also want to talk very briefly about some of the other criminality that we were hearing about, because it turns out, of course, that much of this was false. We've all heard these horror stories that were repeated by the media of gang rapes and mass murders and three-year-olds and seven-year-olds being molested in the Superdome and the convention center, a three-year-old having his or her throat slit and being stuffed in a freezer in the convention center was how I heard it originally. And of course, about a week ago, the story started to come out that almost every one of these claims were utterly false. There simply was no evidence of these kinds of crimes happening to any real extent. And now both the National Guard, local law enforcement, and all the media who have examined it are saying, well, you know, we never did have any eyewitnesses. Now, what's fascinating about this is that the media was so quick to report on so-called gang rapes. They were so quick to to report on these so-called mass murders and molestations of children, even though if you go back and you look at some of that footage, none of the people who were claiming that those things had happened ever actually said in front of a camera that they had witnessed this. All of this was on the level of rumor. The media went with it, and more to the point, much of the American public believed it. And I want to ask us to consider for a second what that says about us as a nation when white folks and black folks, because the mayor bought into it, Eddie Compass, who was at that time until very recently the chief of police in New Orleans, bought into it, repeated the claim about mass gang rapes and killings in the Superdome on the Oprah Winfrey Show. What is it about us as a nation that allows us, white and black and otherwise, to buy into these stereotypes? It's as if simply saying that black men were running around raping people and killing people makes so much sense to us that we just naturally assume that it's true. And we don't even demand evidence, because now, as we're finding out, there was no evidence. What's sad about these particular reports is that by virtue of having claimed that you had all these people running around shooting at relief helicopters, which now some of the investigative research suggested, although that happened a few times, it happened only a few, but all of these reports of mass violence actually, we know, delayed relief getting to the people in New Orleans, because you had relief workers who were so afraid because they'd been watching CNN, they'd been watching Fox News, hearing about how dangerous and how deviant and how criminal the folks in New Orleans were, that they were afraid to drive the buses in. They were afraid to bring in any relief workers, and as a result, people suffered longer than they needed to, and in part, this was because of the race and class biased way in which the media reported this particular catastrophe. It's not the only reason that the relief was slow in coming, but it certainly was part of it. What we need to be discussing then is the way in which the media has regularly framed folks of color, not only in New Orleans, but also in general. And so if we are going to respond to the racism of Katrina, it's important not only to respond to the inadequate budgetary allocations for protecting the city of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, not only respond to the slowness of action taken in the wake of the catastrophe on all levels, state, local, and federal. It's not only enough to understand the history of how those communities became so poor and the institutional race and class oppression that was at the root of that, but it's also important that we confront the media and the way in which the media has portrayed these issues, because it has certainly not been in a way that is accurate or that is in the interest of the people of that community. Which really brings us then to a final discussion of what ought to be done in the wake of such a catastrophe. If we now assume that every day is disaster day for low-income folks in this country, if we now assume that institutional race and class bias preceded Katrina, were evident in the wake of Katrina, and are evident today, then we as progressives, as radicals, as those on the left, have to be putting forth some kind of a liberatory vision of where we need to be moving in the wake of this kind of a disaster. And we're certainly not getting that discussed in the mainstream press. And so I want to suggest to those who are interested that there are certain things that we need to be demanding, in addition to greater media accountability, in addition to greater governmental accountability. We've got to have a very clear agenda. And this agenda, of course, is being laid out right now by folks in the communities that have been affected. The fantastic work of Community Labor United, which folks can learn about by going to their website, which is communitylaborunited.net, where you've got folks from the zone, 32 different organizations in the New Orleans area that have come together for the purpose of trying to discuss ways to rebuild that city to the interest and for the needs of the people, the working class of New Orleans, the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Reconstruction Project, working together with Community and Labor United to bring together on a grassroots level a counter proposal to that which is being floated right now, whether it's the repeal of prevailing wage laws and the giving of no-bid contracts to multi-billion dollar corporations, or whether it is the attempt by the mayor, Ray Nagin, to meet very much in private with groups of wealthy elite and mostly white business people in Dallas, as he did a couple of weeks ago, to discuss the reconstruction without any grassroots folks at the table. These organizations, Community Labor United and the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Reconstruction Project, are trying to put forth a much more progressive agenda. Among the things that they are calling for and among the things that we as radicals need to be discussing are first and foremost the right of those who have been displaced by this tragedy to return to their homes and to their communities, and not only the right to return, but making sure that they have the resources and the funds to make that return possible. Secondly, giving those who have been displaced by not only the storm, but by the neglect that preceded and then followed the storm, making sure that those individuals have preference for the jobs that are going to be given for reconstructing the city. They should be the first hired, and they should be paid decent wages, which brings us then to the third of those demands, reinstituting the protections of the Davis-Bacon Act for all federal contracts in the hurricane zone. That is to say, reinstating prevailing wage, which frankly is not even enough. I mean, the prevailing wage in New Orleans as of the time of the hurricane for most work was somewhere between $9 and $14 an hour, depending on the kind of work we're talking about, which is really, depending on the size of your family, not a livable wage, but it's certainly better than the wages that are going to be paid if we allow that repeal of Davis-Bacon to stand. It's also important that we insist and demand that the federal aid for rebuilding that city and the overall Gulf Coast go directly to the grassroots community organizations, not through the larger government bureaucracy of FEMA, not through the, or at least not simply through the Corps of Engineers. There is no evidence that these federal agencies or that any state agency, official state governmental agency, has the desire, the willpower, or the intention of seeing to it that the local communities and folks at the grassroots are empowered. That rebuilding aid should be funneled directly to the local level. It's also important to pass some type of law or to have some type of regulation that would require that a market price be paid for whatever properties are bought up in that community. Right now, you've got real estate speculators who are in New Orleans, who are all throughout the Gulf Coast, offering desperately poor people, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for property that they know they can develop into high-end condominiums or housing for more affluent folks. And if, you know, if you're desperate and somebody offers you $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000, there's a fairly good chance that you're going to take it. The only way that we can ensure that folks' interests are taken care of is to demand that fair market price be paid. If folks really do want to sell their property for fair market value, that obviously is up to them, but we should not encourage or allow rampant real estate speculation, the likes of which we're seeing at this particular point. It's also important on an environmental level that we demand a rebuilding and a restoration of the wetlands and the natural barriers on the Gulf Coast, which, had they not been eroded to the point they are today, could have absorbed at least some of the impact of this particular storm and future storms. If we do not do that, we're going to continue to see those coastal towns and cities erode, and we're going to continue to see these kinds of disasters. So that money absolutely has to be provided, and quickly. It's important that we demand mixed-income housing development in communities so that folks will have affordable housing, not only paying fair market value for the properties that are bought, but then making sure that whatever is rebuilt is going to include a significant portion of the houses, the apartments, the residences in that area for affordable housing for low-income and working-class families. It's very important that we make sure that those who are undocumented immigrants who are right now in evacuation centers trying to get relief are not going to be deported. They're not going to be punished. They're not going to be rounded up right now. There are already reports coming out of some of these evacuation centers of undocumented immigrants who are, in fact, an undocumented labor that is being harassed and threatened with potential deportation. You've got a lot of these folks, for example, working in the casinos in the Biloxi area who now are in real trouble. Some of these folks, by the way, were documented, and they were here on temporary guest worker visas working for some of these large casinos, but those temporary work visas, or whatever the proper terminology is, make it very clear that they were only allowed to be in the country so long as they were working for the Isle of Capri Casino, for example, or whatever casino they might have worked for. And now that those casinos have been destroyed, technically speaking, they are no longer entitled to be in the country. We have to demand that those persons who are here trying to better their lives and their family situation are allowed to remain and are not going to be punished because of this particular catastrophe. And unfortunately, I'm afraid unless we make that demand very clear, that a lot of the undocumented immigrants, many of them Caribbean, Jamaican, Mexican, Central American immigrants who are working in the Gulf Coast, you have about 145,000 Mexican laborers in the Gulf Coast region who have been forgotten in this catastrophe, many of them undocumented or at least here only on temporary work, are going to find it very difficult to be safe from potential deportation orders or other forms of harassment. So those are the kinds of demands that we need to be putting forward, in addition, obviously, to a massive public works program that would be demilitarized, that would be controlled at the grassroots level. We're talking about really a Marshall Plan for the region, if you will, a Works Progress Administration type program where hundreds of billions of dollars would be not only given in terms of funds, but the power to control that money given to the local community. And for those who want to find out more about other demands that are being made and the folks who are ready to hit the ground running, and also where you can get involved and contribute other than just sending money to a multi-million dollar bureaucracy, the likes of the Red Cross, sending money to the local level where the grassroots organizations can really do the best work, I should absolutely check out that website, communitylaborunited.net, and check out the work that People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Reconstruction Project and Community Labor United is doing. Again, these are more than 30 different organizations in the greater New Orleans area. area that have come together to work on these projects and to ensure that the working class people of the Gulf region have a say, and more than just a say, but ultimately have autonomy and self-determination and control in the rebuilding of this region. Because what we have seen in the Gulf is the very unnatural, man-made, human-created disaster of race and class oppression. It took Katrina to bring that to the attention of the larger American public. But what we must do is bring forth this narrative that suggests that, unfortunately, we have gone far too long neglecting the needs of low-income folks, particularly of color and those who are low-income. And unless we demand a different set of federal, state, and local priorities, and unless we demand that those politicians who claim to care about the poor and claim to care about the working class, unless we demand that they actually do so, and unless we begin to demand the creation of alternative institutions that can promote real self-sufficiency, we're going to continue to get the kinds of disasters that we see, or perhaps the kind that we don't see every day in this country, but which Katrina have brought to our attention in such stark relief. And so I hope that from this point forward, we won't get bogged down in a simple discussion of who's to blame, George Bush, Kathleen Blanco, Ray Nagin, et cetera. The real issue here is a political, economic, and social system which has always and forever prioritized the needs of the haves at the expense of the have-nots and continues to do so to this day. And I hope that we will insist that the public's attention remain on this long after the cameras have left New Orleans, long after the reconstruction has begun, and that we will continue to demand attention, not only on the part of the media, but on the part of politicians and on the part of ourselves, to the kinds of racial and class oppression which continue to go on. And I think if we do that, and I think if we push for real self-determination and real autonomy and the control of the resources of those communities by the people who live in those communities, then we have the opportunity to rebuild New Orleans and the Gulf Coast in a much better way. If, unfortunately, we continue business as usual, if we allow the program cuts that are now being proposed to go through, we're going to find that for every dollar we spend to reconstruct and to rebuild the lives of those who have been damaged and destroyed by this particular storm and by the flooding, we'll be taking a dollar away on the other end. So the real issue in closing is to suggest that the issue is not whether George W. Bush cares about black people in Kanye West terms, but really whether we in this country and whether this system cares about black folks, whether this system cares about low-income folks of all colors and working-class folks. And I would suggest that at least as of now, the unfortunate but I think quite unavoidable answer to that question is that we don't. And it'll be up to us to change that reality in whatever way, shape, or form that we can.
Now the city is in ruins.
You've been listening to part two of Disasters Natural and Otherwise, Race, Class, and the Destruction of New Orleans with Tim Wise.
Where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth. Where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored. Where the very end of life is the place we're heading toward. Where it's more than just a metaphor.
And to hear part one of this Tim Wise special and other archived Building Bridges national shows, go to www.buildingbridgesradio.org. That's www.buildingbridgesradio.org. This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report national special, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.